morning, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning on several stations, including the one you're listening on. And if you're listening to the live broadcast, which seems likely, unless you're catching it on the archives on the Internet later on, you can call in the course of this half hour if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or maybe you even have a difference of opinion from the host you'd like to express. Feel free to call me. We have only a short time, so you'll want to get on the line as early as you can. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Let's talk to John, first of all, calling from Torrance, California. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. I'm hitting the button, but he's not active. Oh, there we go.
Hi, good morning, Steve. How are you?
Good morning. Good
evening. All right. I just wanted to call. I was reading in the book of Revelation, chapter 1. I wanted to focus on verses 12 through 16, but specifically in verse 13, when it mentions, in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the path with a golden girdle. Just wanted to ask your opinion of who is this one like the Son of Man?
Well, the one like the Son of Man that John saw in Revelation chapter 1 apparently is Christ, because when he speaks, he says things that really only Christ could say. For example, he says, I was dead and I'm now alive and live forevermore. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, and so forth. So it would appear that the one who is said to be like the Son of Man is Christ. Now, perhaps the problem arises with saying, well, why, since Christ is the Son of Man, why would he be described as one like the Son of Man? I'm not somebody like me. I am me. Why would Jesus be called one like the Son of Man if he, in fact, is the Son of Man? I'm sure that's probably what gives rise to the question. And the answer is not an easy one necessarily, but I would say that the expression one like the Son of Man is no doubt borrowed from Daniel chapter 7, where in verses 13 and 14, Daniel sees one who is said to be one like the Son of Man, or one like a Son of Man, which is just a Hebraism that means a human form, someone who is human-like. Son of Man in the Old Testament is a common expression, but not of Christ. Jesus used it of himself in the Gospels a great deal, but in the Old Testament, the Son of Man is never used as a messianic title. Son of Man appears probably 70 times in the Old Testament, but it always simply means a mere man. It means a human. And so when Daniel says in Daniel 7, I saw one like a Son of Man, or the Son of Man, he means I saw someone like a human. And this is in contrast to what he saw earlier in the chapter, because at first he saw something like a lion, a beast like a lion coming out of the sea. Then he saw one that was like a bear. Then he saw one that was like a leopard. And eventually he sees something like a human. So that we have these animals and this human form representing different powers. The lion represented Babylon, the bear represented Media Persia, the leopard represented the Grecian Empire. I believe the one like a human represents the kingdom of God. And of course, we associate the kingdom of God rightly with Jesus himself. He's the king. So he appears also to John in Revelation chapter 1. And John uses similar language to that which Daniel used. I saw one like the Son of Man, which may mean one like Jesus, since he called himself the Son of Man. Or it may just mean one like a human. I saw a human form. This could be in contrast to other creatures that John describes that had four faces and so forth. A lot of things that John saw weren't very human-looking. But this person he saw, it's like saying, I saw a man. But the particular man he saw, I believe, was Christ. And I think the expression, one like the Son of Man, may simply be a literary borrowing from Daniel. I don't know if that's confusing.
Yeah, well, the reason I'm asking the question is because even in the other context where you're mentioning, I believe in that context where he sees the beast and the one like a man, my understanding of that is that that's the description of angelic beings. And the reason I'm saying that is because if you go back to verse 1 in the book of Revelation, in the first, very first verse, it says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must surely come to pass. And he sent, he being Jesus, Christ, and signified by his angel unto his servant John. There appears to be an order here where the Father gives this revelation to Jesus. Jesus signifies and sends it by an angel to give to John. So the suggestion here is because of this order that the individual possibly is an angelic being.
Well, that's possible. It says in Revelation 1:1 that he sent it by, not by an angel, but by his angel. And the word angelos, angel, means messenger. It could be he's talking about an ordinary angel that came as a messenger of Jesus, and that, you know, what he saw was not really Jesus, but was this this angel. Or it's possible that it's saying that this was the messenger of Christ, which might have been an appearance of Christ. The angel of the Lord in the Old Testament was the Lord himself, like in the burning bush. It says the angel of the Lord appeared in the bush. And then later, as he's speaking, he says, and the Lord said, when it's really the angel of the Lord speaking, the identification of the angel of the Lord with the Lord himself is something that is kind of hard to analyze in the Old Testament. And we may have the same phenomenon going on here, but I don't know. You could be right. You could be right. It may be that this angel, although he speaks as if he is Jesus, because he certainly says things that only Jesus could say, that he is simply a mouthpiece for Jesus, speaking on his behalf. And, you know, I wouldn't have any problem with that. It is rather complicated, frankly. And I'm not really sure even that having the right answer would be more beneficial than not having an answer. I'm not sure what benefit it would be to know. But it does, our curiosity is piqued. But as in many things in the Bible, and especially in the book of Revelation, there's much there to pique our curiosity and yet not to follow up with the satisfaction of our curiosity. There's many things that are there that simply are not explained to us, and this is one of them that I don't fully understand. Some do, perhaps. If they do, then they're ahead of me in this.
Well, thank you very much. You were very helpful, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you, FD.
Okay, John. Thanks for your call, brother. God bless. Okay, we'll talk next to another John. This John is from Lemon Grove, California. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. My question is on Matthew 5:16. The context is, you are the light of the world. City that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. And my question is...
Right.
My question is that a lot of times we do good works, but people, you know, I do something nice for somebody, and they say, that was really nice of you, but I'm not too sure how it glorifies God.
Yeah,
Yeah,
Jesus said, as you pointed out, Jesus said, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. And yet in the next chapter, in chapter 6, verse 1, it says, when you do your good works, don't do them to be seen by men, or else you have no reward from your Father in heaven.
Right.
So, on the one hand, Jesus said, let your light shine so people will see your good works. And then, in the other place, he says, don't be like the hypocrites, don't do your works to be seen by men. And I think that the difference in nuance is, in chapter 5, it says, you should do your works in such a way that God gets the glory. That when people see your good works, they don't glorify you, they glorify your Father in heaven. Whereas the Pharisees do all their good works so that they will be glorified, so they'll get the credit and God will not. So it's all about motivation. Now, like you said, when you do a kind act, people may see your kindness and give you the credit. They may say, well, that was very nice of you. And I guess your concern in the matter should be that you don't take any of the glory away from God. Now, it's not always possible for you to give a full explanation of the fact that, well, the reason that you did them good is because you are, you know, a servant of Jesus Christ, and he is the one who wishes them well, and he's the one who has, you know, sent you to do that good act for them. You may or may not have the chance to explain that. If you don't, it's not your fault. But if you can get that across, then of course what you're saying is, you know, I'm not denying that I did a good work, but I do want you to, you know, give credit where credit's due. You know, I'm not really such a great person, but my Lord has sent me to do this kindness because he's great and he cares about you. I'm not saying anyone has to say those exact words. I'm just saying that that's the kind of message you hope to get across whenever you do a good deed. It's not always possible, and you should always do good deeds, whether it's possible to give that kind of explanation or not, because God delights in good and good things. But Jesus indicates that you should really live the kind of life that will, as Paul put it when he's writing to Timothy, that will adorn the gospel. And that is, if you live a life of good works, not necessarily specific good works, like, you know, helping a little old lady cross the street, but just really a good life, a life of virtue, a life of honesty, a life of benevolence, a life of fairness and justice. If your whole behavior, your pattern of life is good, it will go toward bringing people toward God, because they will actually see that that his people are good and that God makes a difference in a good way in people's lives. So, actually, Peter, I was looking for it in 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter talks about people who are suffering, and he says that we should be looking for the verse where it says that people should be able to see your good works and glorify your Father in the day of visitation. I have a hard time looking for things while I'm on the air, but Peter seems to be alluding to, oh, here it is. It's 1 Peter 2:12. Yeah, it says that you should have your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, what this apparently means is the good works they observe is your honorable conduct. It's not even necessarily referring to the specific acts of generosity that you do. Those should be of a piece with your whole character and your whole behavior, that you're a generous person. But it's your whole conduct, your whole character as a Christian should advertise the validity of your belief system, so that, as opposed to the opposite is when Christians behave inappropriately and it communicates to people that your religion is fake. So I think what Jesus is saying and what Peter is saying is that you should be authentically good. You should live a life that reflects the character of Christ in all your dealings. And this at least avoids giving people an excuse to reject God. They may find other excuses, but you do give them an excuse to reject God if you do evil. Remember when Nathan the prophet said to David that David's sin with Bathsheba, said, "You have given the enemies of the Lord occasion to blaspheme." Well, that's the problem. When a person who's publicly one of God's people does what is publicly scandalous, they give the enemies of God an opportunity to blaspheme. And I think what Jesus is saying, don't do that. You know, be the kind of person whose life is consistent with what you profess to believe. And then, although not everyone will glorify God for it, it will at least not hinder them from doing so. And Peter said, in the day of visitation, which might be someday off in the future when God is dealing with the people, they will have to remember your good testimony and glorify God in it. It's hard to know exactly how that works out in every case, because obviously everyone's circumstances are different and good conduct is manifested in tons of different situations. But the bottom line seems to be in both these passages that a Christian's good conduct provides a good advertisement for God and will tend to turn people more to God than if a Christian is a bad advertisement. And when a Christian lives a godly life, a Christ-like life, they are adorning their message, Paul said. That means making it attractive by their life.
Thank you. That clears it up a lot.
Well, not completely, it doesn't, but I appreciate your generosity in saying that. I feel like I can't totally clear it up, but I think these are the thoughts that lie behind that
Well, I think the main sounds like the main thing is the inward and the outward have to need to be the same.
Well, that's right. You need to talk the same way that you walk.
Right. The whole character. It was just a, you know, it, when Jesus did something, you know, like lay hands on somebody and they got healed, then it's obvious that, you know, there was it wasn't the work of man. It was
right.
The work of God, even though Jesus was God. But I mean,
that's right. When Jesus healed the man who was paralyzed, who was lowered through the roof by his four friends, it says the people glorified God who had given such power to men.
Right.
In other words, I mean, Jesus did a miracle. Yeah. Jesus did a miracle, and people glorified God for it. I mean, somehow the way Jesus did good works drew attention to his Father,
right?
To himself too. I mean, you can't be invisible. Easily. You might wish you could be, but you can't be invisible when you're doing good works. They have to be seen. But there should be something in the manner in which you do it that discourages people from focusing on you and giving you the credit. How that is done is probably not going to be the same way in every case. But certainly it is the opposite of what some people do, who, like the Pharisees, they sound a trumpet before themselves before they give an alms so that people see their good works and think well of them. You know, you can't really help the fact that some people will think well of you when you do a good work. That's just your duty to do a good work. And if people think well of you, that's not your fault. But you shouldn't be doing it in order to gain that result. You should do it with the mind to bring people to the place where they can see Jesus better and glorify God.
Thank you.
Okay, brother. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Mark from San Jose, California. Mark, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Mr. Greg, I called you a month ago and asked you to read Charles Chenecky, who is Abraham Lincoln's best friend's book, 50 Years in the Church of Rome. Did you get time to do that?
I have not laid my hands on that book, but I'd be glad to have it if someone wants to send it to me. It sounded very interesting when you talked about it.
Yeah. Now, you're pretty good in linguistics. I was wondering, you know, when one uses the John or the Latern or the restroom, where did the word Latern come from? Do you know the origination of that?
Well, you're talking about like the Third Lateran Council and so forth?
Right. The Latern, where the
Lateran
Catholic.
Well, Lateran is not the same word as latrine.
Oh, okay. You're good at that, Mr. Greg. Okay. Well, anyway,
I'm not an expert in languages, but I know the difference between Lateran and latrine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, see, that's why you're a talk show host and I'm a listener. But
that's why I get paid the big bucks. Yeah.
Yeah. the thing is, though, in all seriousness, you know, in that book Charles Chenecky wrote, which basically was his diary, he mentioned the fact that at the Council of Lateran, it was determined that if you were to kill a heretic, you would obtain forgiveness of sins. And, you know, when I think about how Abraham Lincoln definitely was assassinated by the Jesuits, and we now have a Jesuit governor, Jerry Brown, as our governor, who signed AB 48, where they are forcing the homosexual agenda from as young as kindergarten on up by law. You know, I think, my oh my, you know, things are getting bad because, you know, Abraham Lincoln himself said...
things have been bad for a very long time. It's true. And, you know, frankly, I don't know that Jerry Brown is a Jesuit, but if he is...
Oh, he is. Yeah.
We've had other governors and presidents who are bad things, too, whether Jesuit or not. I mean, let's face it, anybody who is not committed to justice and righteousness is not going to be an ideal ruler. And a person can be evil in many ways. They can be an evil Jesuit or an evil atheist or an evil whoremonger or whatever. But the thing is, we're not too surprised that we have evil men in government. They are elected by an evil electorate. You know, as long as the population is committed to evil, they're going to select people that please them in ways that are not good. And so I'm afraid that's probably why we have a lot of the politicians we now have. Anyway, brother, I need to take some more calls. I'm running out of time, but I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Elizabeth from Whittier, California. Elizabeth, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding John chapter 4, when, mm-hmm. and I have it, I actually, I read from the Complete Jewish Bible, but I'm also looking at the New King James Bible. But when the Lord Jesus, when he went to Samaria, and he ran into the Samaritan woman and asked her for a drink, and she responds, how is it that you, being a Jew, you know, speak to me? Because apparently there was no dealings with the Jew, Samaritans. Jews did not associate with them. But then it goes on to say that when she says, our father Jacob, you know, our father Jacob who gave us the well, drank it himself. See, and then later on when he says about her husband, that she was living with a man that wasn't her husband, she'd had five husbands, I couldn't figure out, well, okay, so she's had five husbands. Was she married to Jewish people? Is she a Jew? Is she not a Jew? She called the well.
No, she was not a Jew. She was not a Jew, and she probably wasn't married to Jewish men. She lived in Samaria, and she was Samaritan. So her husband
probably. Why did she call her father Jacob, who gave her the well to drink from?
The Samaritans, the Samaritans were descended from Jacob, as the Jews were. The Samaritans had similar roots. It's just that the Samaritans had intermarried with Gentiles a great deal, so that they had Jacob in their ancestry as well as other streams. Other ethnic streams, whereas the Jews prided themselves that they remained strictly racially pure. They believed that their ancestors had stayed within the marriageable rules of marrying Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Now the Samaritans had descended from the people of Ephraim and the other 10 tribes to the north that had broken off from Judah in the time of Rehoboam. And these people had been conquered in 722 B.C. by the Assyrians and had been mostly deported and infiltrated by Gentiles. And so by the time of Christ, which was like 700 years later, this group of people had greatly intermixed with Jewish and Gentile, or we should say Israeli and Gentile blood. So the Jews, who had kept themselves considerably more ethnically pure, they looked down on the Samaritans because they had not, because they had a lot of Gentile blood, but they also had Jacob in their ancestry too. Now, another reason that the Jews looked down on the Samaritans was that not only were the Samaritans racially compromised, they were also religiously compromised. They had set up an alternative temple at Mount Gerizim instead of the one in Jerusalem, and they had their own rituals and so forth that were deviated in some ways from those in Jerusalem. So the Jewish people, whose center of worship was in Jerusalem, they saw themselves as ethnically and religiously pure, but they saw the Samaritans as ethnically and religiously compromised. And so that's why there was hostility.
Okay. And so then my question again is, at the end, after his visit of 2 days, others believe in him. So, and remember when he said that he didn't come, he only came to the Jewish people, but yet at the end, I guess those Samaritans who aren't pure Jewish believe in him as the Messiah. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, Jesus didn't say he came only to the Jews. He said he only came to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And again, the Samaritans were descended from Israel, just not purely, you know.
Okay.
But Jesus, Jesus actually would minister to Gentiles too, but he was not sent on a Gentile mission. He was sent on a mission to Israel. But a Gentile could persuade him, if they had adequate faith, to minister to them too. Like the Syrophoenician woman or the centurion. They were Gentiles. And Jesus did miracles for them, even though they were not Jewish, because he said, I have not seen such great faith in all of Israel, when he said about the centurion. And so, basically, if a Gentile had faith, they could get the same blessing that a Jew could get.
And my other question in regards to the same area is, when Jesus told the Samaritan woman, you've had five husbands, and the one you're living with isn't your husband, I had to figure out, well, what is he trying to decide? Was there a ritual that they had to do five times to literally become a husband, versus she's living with a man, which is what right now even Christians, non-Christians, do that. They live together. What was the difference? What does it mean to be a husband married and versus just living with the man?
Well, to be married means that you've gone through, you've made a commitment making vows. You've entered into a covenant relationship, which at least is verbally said to be for life. Now, people break those vows, unfortunately, and it doesn't always end up being for life. But when a person enters into a covenant of marriage, they're making an agreement for life. And she had had five such agreements. Now, we don't know how those agreements had ended. It's possible that her husbands had abandoned her or she had abandoned them, but for whatever reason, she had had five actual commitments like that to men. But the man she was with now, she had no such commitment to. Now, when we talk about people living together today, we say, well, what's the difference between that and being married? The difference is, of course, the intention. People who are truly married intend and commit and promise to stay together for life. They should never break that promise. Some do, but they shouldn't. But at least the intention is there that they're going to be a lifelong couple. A couple that's living together without getting married don't have that intention, or else they'd get married. You know, if you have that intention, then you'll have no objection to getting married. The fact that a person objects to getting married but wants to live together, that means they don't have any intention of staying together for life. They may be taking it day by day. They may think, well, maybe we'll stay together for life. We'll just see about that as things go along. But they're not really making a commitment like marriage is. And that's why Jesus didn't recognize her present relationship as marriage, whereas he seemed to recognize the first five as actual marriage. Anyway, as you can tell from the whistling, we're out of time. This time goes by really quickly. If you'd like to be involved in a longer version of this show, we have one every afternoon. You can catch it on the internet from our website. We have an hour version of this show from 2 to 3 every weekday afternoon Pacific time. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Now, The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the radio time. If we don't pay, we go off the air. If you'd like to help us out, go to our website and check out thenarrowpath.com. You'll find a link there that tells you how to make a donation, and if you do that, we'll be closer to staying on the air than if you don't. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless.